Welcome to the middle of the air.
Last week we were passing through Richmond, Virginia. We stopped at the Poe Museum and were delighted to have a conversation with Chris Sumner, a longtime scholar of the life and works of Edgar Allan Poe and curator of the Poe Museum. The museum itself includes a beautiful old stone house on East Main Street. We started talking about the house and moved on from there.
They were telling me at the front desk it was built in the 1700s, mid-1700s?
Yes, the house is called the Old Stone House. It serves as an entrance to the Poe Museum complex, but even during Poe's lifetime, they'd forgotten how old it was. There's a guidebook to the city from the 1840s that says they don't remember when it was built. Uh-huh. A lot of the records in town were at the courthouse down the street. It was burned by the British during the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
So the first record we have of the house dates to 1783, and by then it's a very old house, and it wasn't valued very highly. But the floorboards in the west room, they've dated those using dendrochronology to about 1754.
Wow. So I want to just ask you some questions about Poe. What I'd really like to know is, what was Poe like, as much as you can tell us about that? In other words, would I have liked him? Would I have liked to have gone out for a beer or dinner with Edgar Allan Poe?
Well, I think you would have liked him. He had a great sense of humor. His friends just thought he was a very interesting fellow, didn't dominate the conversation, but always had really great things to contribute. And he was a welcome guest at these weekly literary soirees in New York City, would attend every week. And people said he was the one that everybody wanted to meet, not just because he was a celebrity, but because there was something magnetic about his personality. So he's somebody that people wanted to know. And they said that even if they didn't understand what he was talking about, these things he was saying were just so interesting and so compelling that he could hold people spellbound for hours. And he was a performer, so he would go on the road and give lectures or poetry readings, and sold-out crowds would attend just spellbound, and afterwards he would just leave the stage to unbounded applause. So he was somebody you'd want to know, but you wouldn't want to go have a beer with him. He suffered some kind of inability to break down alcohol. After a glass of wine, he was staggering drunk. He'd be sick for days afterwards. So he really couldn't handle his alcohol. It was some kind of hereditary problem. His sister apparently had the same problem.
Interesting. So that answers another question I was going to ask you, which was he well known in his own lifetime?
Oh, yes. Poe was a celebrity even during his own lifetime. The Raven was a big hit on both sides of the Atlantic. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote to Poe and said that it had created a terror and a fit sensation in England, and that her friends were reading it to each other to terrify each other. And Poe is known by Charles Dickens. When Dickens was in the United States, he made a point of meeting Poe in Philadelphia, and they had a conversation and both tried to get each other's works published on each side of the Atlantic. And he was also known in France. And shortly after The Raven came out, of 1846, Charles Baudelaire discovered Poe and helped promote him in France. But he was a household name in France because about 1846, the Murders in the Rue Morgue, Poe's first detective story, was published. And then somebody else published it. And then the first publisher accused the second one of plagiarizing him. So they went to court over this, and it was a big sensational trial until a third publisher came out and said, well, neither of you wrote that. It was some American called Edgar Poe. So now he's a big hit in France, too. And actually, his most popular short story during his lifetime was The Gold Bug.
The Gold Bug.
And it's a treasure hunt mystery. And it was adapted into a stage play during Poe's lifetime. It was reprinted in newspapers and magazines around the world. And just in the United States, Poe estimated it had a circulation of about 400,000 copies between all the different places published. And this is a country with only about 20 million people in it at that point.
So, was The Raven his first big hit, so to speak? What propelled him into the level of fame that you were describing?
I think it was a combination. It started out with The Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Purloined Letter and The Gold Bug. Those detective stories really put him on the map. And then,
and how were they published? Were they in magazines or standalone books?
Yeah, well, The Murders in the Rue Morgue was first published in Graham's Magazine, where Poe was the editor. Mm-hmm. And in a year's time, He'd increased the circulation of Grahams from about 6,000 copies a month, which was pretty good back then, to about 40,000. And that made it the most widely circulated magazine in the country and the first magazine in America with a truly mass audience. And then from there, it was reprinted in gift books and other magazines. There wasn't a really effective copyright law. There was no international copyright law, but even the domestic ones weren't enforced. So as soon as he got printed one place, he could reprint it other places. And the Purloined Letter, he originally published that in a little annual called The Gift. But within weeks of it being set in print, it was reprinted in Edinburgh. And this is the same pattern we see throughout his work. So he was gradually growing up popularity this way. And a lot of his stories would appear in the major magazines of the time, including Godey's Lay's Book, which had a circulation of about 100,000 copies a month. That's what printed the Cask of Amontillado. So a lot of people were seeing his works. And his career actually started out as a literary critic. And he worked at Richmond's Southern Literary Messenger. And Richmond's kind of a backwater. It was really known for its politicians. You like Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson had come out of the Richmond area. But it wasn't known for its writing. So this magazine called the Southern Literary Messenger was starting to cultivate Southern literature. And when Poe got there, it was struggling, had circulation about 500 copies a month. And he started contributing his short stories, he started editing, he started contributing book reviews. And he started taking on the big cities up north, Boston and New York and the writers up there. And he called out the practice of puffery, or one author gets his friends to puff up his book so it'll sell better.
Okay.
And he held up writing to a higher standard, but he's also really caustic in his criticism. One of his first reviews in The Messenger, he begins by saying, "The most remarkable aspect of this production is the bad paper on which it is printed." And he finishes up by advising the author to shoot himself.
Oh, my gosh.
So within a year, he increased the magazine's circulation 7 times, made the most popular journal in the South, and made him a national reputation. As a really biting, vicious literary critic, the Tomahawk Man. So he was well known as a literary critic in these literary circles, but then with the Gold Bug and the Raven, he had a popular reputation. He was a household name after the Raven.
Was talk a little bit about what, you know, for a recreational reader back then, what was the landscape like? Were you... We already talked about magazines and serial. Did they serialize in newspapers then, too?
Yeah, they serialized in newspapers and magazines, and the printing process had greatly improved. So you went in Poe's lifetime from printing presses that could maybe print 60 copies an hour to ones that could print 1,000 an hour. So you had these steam-powered printing presses. You were able to mass-produce magazines, so the price of magazines was really reducing. But books were still expensive, and they were had gift books with nice gilded designs on the covers, and you could sell these around Christmas time as great Christmas gifts. But Poe thought the future of literature is the magazines, and magazines wanted something different than the books. The books wanted a long, continuous work, a novel, or maybe a book of poetry or a textbook, and Poe played that game. He wrote a novel called The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. He wrote a textbook on seashells, which is a great seller. But he said magazines want short works that you can read all in one sitting. He said that they did like these serialized works, but he said the problem with these serialized novels was you lose the impact because you read one segment one week and then you have to wait and wait for the next one to come out, and you lose the momentum. And he thought if you read a short story, you get the whole thing in one sitting, you get all the momentum of that all at once.
And what kind of stories were popular? I know... You know, we think of Poe as the sort of the mysterious horror kind of the dark side. Was that a popular genre, or did he sort of initiate that?
That was pretty popular, and the big authors in the United States right then were James Fenimore Cooper, did The Last of the Mohicans, and Poe criticized him, thought he didn't understand plot, and people only pretended to like his works because he wrote about American settings. And then after that, the really big name was Washington Irving.
Oh, sure.
And he was a household name. But after that, there were a lot of Gothic romances. And the tradition of the Gothic romance goes back to the 1700s, these stories about haunted castles and family curses and ghosts and goblins. And Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto is a good example of the Gothic romance. And this came to America, and we had other Gothic writers, but Poe decided he wanted to do something a little bit different. He took out the supernatural element, and he focused on the psychology of the characters. And this was a time when there were only a few mental hospitals in the United States, and the science of psychology is getting mixed up with phrenology and mesmerism and other pseudosciences. And Poe wrote about characters who seem normal and they gradually go insane over the course of the story.
Right.
And he focused on the internal dialogue of these characters and what makes them tick. And then he took out the element of the moral. And a good Gothic story should have a villain who gets punished or vanquished. The hero should be rewarded. Virtue should be rewarded. Villainy should be punished. But here's Poe writing stories like The Cask of Amontillado, where Montresor murders Fortunato, leaves him for dead, and is never punished. He's telling you the story 50 years later, and he's joking about it. There's all this sly humor throughout the story. Or Hop Frog. Hop Frog and Trippetta viciously murder the king and his ministers, and they get away with the crime, and they're not punished, and we sympathize with them. Because Poe takes out that element of moral judgment, and he focuses on the psychology of the characters, what makes them tick, and also he focuses on the emotional impact the story should have. Mm-hmm. He said that no longer should stories just be didactic. A great work of art should make you feel something. And he focuses his stories. He creates them almost like a mousetrap.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make sure everything springs just right. So when you hit it just here, that mousetrap's going to spring. He called it a unified effect. So every word, every sentence, even the blank space on the page should lead up to that emotional impact.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that Poe wrote these stories, but he also wrote about the art of writing.
Yes. He actually wrote a whole essay called The Philosophy of Composition, where he explained how he wrote The Raven, why he wrote it that way, the subject of it. And he started out by explaining that the sole province of a poem was beauty. It should no longer be didactic. Don't listen to those transcendentalists who are telling us that we have to write poetry that educates or edifies us. And he said, well, if the sole province of beauty, the sole purpose of a poem is to be beautiful, what should make you feel? And he said, well, what feelings does he associate with beauty? And he said, whenever he defines beauty, he defines it with how it makes you feel. And beauty is that which brings your soul to tears. It's something that really impacts your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So he said that a beautiful poem had to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
And the saddest thing he could possibly imagine was also a subject that combined beauty and death all in one, was the death of a beautiful young woman. So he had this subject, he had this feeling he wanted to evoke, and then he tried to come up with words and images that would evoke that. And he said the sound of the oh, that nevermore sound, just even without speaking English, you would know that was a feeling of melancholy. So he tried to repeat that oh sound at the end of each stanza. And he came with this word, nevermore. That would really evoke that feeling he's going for. But it would sound kind of silly if a person just kept saying nevermore over and over again. It would ruin the impact. So he said, well, maybe just some bird that doesn't know what he's saying. Maybe a parrot. And he thought, well, that's too colorful. Maybe a raven, the black plumage of the raven enhances that feeling. And that way, every element of the poem leads up to that feeling of melancholy. He actually said he started with the end of the poem first and worked his way backwards to try to build up all the tension that led to that single emotional impact at the very end. That's my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
It's fascinating to me. You know, we assume that these guys like Poe just sit down, pick up a pen, and start scratching away. And it's fascinating. And really, it shouldn't be that surprising to find out that, no, there was a lot of thought went into the structure, the subject, the sound, and everything like that.
Oh, yeah. He worked for years editing different poems or stories. Even after he published a story, he might completely revise it and republish it later in a new version. He was so exacting even with a short poem like To Helen, he made constant changes to that until it came to its final version, and Tamburlaine. That's one of his longer poems. It started out with about 400 lines. Then he cut it down to about 235 lines, then back up to 400. So he's always revising his works, always perfecting it. So nothing was really left to chance, even different word choices. Like it might be he changed it from screaming to whispering or screaming to shouting, and just he's really concerned about those subtle differences and how they impacted the reader's emotion.
Let me ask you about Murders on the Rue Morgue. We talked a little bit about that being a really popular one. Would it be too strong if I said Edgar Allan Poe invented Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, yeah, about 50 years before the first Sherlock Holmes mystery came out. And this even predates the Wilkie Collins mysteries.
And you can't read Murder on the Rue Morgue without realizing that's where Sherlock Holmes came from, right?
Oh, yeah, and even Sherlock Holmes will reference Poe's character, Auguste Dupin. And there's one instant where Watson says, "You remind me of that Poe character, Dupin," and Sherlock Holmes says, "No, I'm much smarter than he is. That's only a parlor trick he's doing." But Poe is laying out a new sort of literary genre. And it came with the first part was just the detective, this idea of a character. Living in a time when most police departments would just patrol the neighborhood. They'd take up regular patrols. If there were a crime that happening, they'd try to stop the crime or catch the culprit. If the crime had already been committed, they try to get a confession out of somebody. They interrogate everybody that person knew and try to get a confession, or they'd have to catch somebody in the act. Mm-hmm. But police departments in America hadn't evolved very far. But in France, there were the new science of criminology, and Poe's very interested, and that's probably why he set three of his detective stories in France, because that's where the latest in criminology is taking place. In his stories, he shows crime scene investigation, and he tries to get into the mind of the killer. So he's really trying to understand what makes the killers tick. He's also analyzing the crime scene for different things like stray hairs or anything that's unusual or out of place. And he came up with a lot of standard plot devices for the genre. And in addition to just having this new kind of character who solves crimes using acute observation of the crime scene, analysis, criminal profiling, even criminal surveillance, but he also came up with the sidekick who follows around to make him look good.
Exactly, yeah.
And he came up with standard devices like the least likely suspect. And thou art the man, it's the least likely suspect. And he came up with the idea of the villain who scatters false clues to frame somebody else. That's also from thou art the man, or the psychological third degree. That's where the detective tricks the villain to confessing. Or the murders in the Rue Morgue is the first locked door mystery. That's where somebody's murdered inside a locked room that's still locked from the inside, so the police break down the door. They can't figure out how the murderer could have escaped without them seeing him. How is this impossible crime possible? And that's another of Poe's devices. He also wrote the first major treasure hunt mystery and the first detective story solved using a cryptogram. That's the gold bug. They have to decode a cryptogram. That gives them a series of clues they have to follow to find a buried treasure. Mm-hmm. And he also did the first comic detective story, which is Thou Art the Man. And The Mystery of Marie Roget is the first detective story based on a true crime.
I'm not familiar with that one, Thou Art the Man. What is that about?
That is about this rich old man who's disappeared. And they find some of his bloody clothing, and it's mixed up with this really shifty character, and they think, well, this shifty guy, he's the one who did it. So let's send him off to jail, and his benevolent nephew says, you know, I'm gonna help out the investigation. I miss my poor good uncle, and he takes the police all over the city, and they look through the woods and the swamps searching for his clothing, and they can't find him. But they do find evidence that implicates the other guy. But the detective, he looks at this and says, well, isn't it weird that this good, benevolent nephew who's supposed to help him out took them every place but this one spot? He very conspicuously missed this one spot. So he goes to that little swamp and he finds the old man's corpse. And he decides, well, you know, I could just reveal what he's done, but I want to get a confession. And he knows the nephew now. He's rolling in money. He's inherited all this money. He knows he loves wine. So he delivers a box of wine to his house, a big crate. And when he opens it up, the old man's corpse pops out of it and points at him and says, "Thou art the man." So the murderer then confesses just before he dies of a heart attack. So apparently he'd stuffed the old man into the crate and put a whale rib inside of him and flattened out the whale rib, so as soon as the box opened, the man would just pop up out of the box. Ooh. And then he used ventriloquism skills to voice into the old man.
So let me ask you this. Do you have, this is probably not a fair question, but do you have a personal favorite poem or story?
I probably have a few. There's Hop Frog is a good funny one, and it starts out as just a really strange comedy and goes really dark from there. And there's also Never Bet the Devil Your Head, a tale with a moral. Mm-hmm. And that's a story in which Poe is making fun of the transcendentalists. They've complained that his stories have no moral. They're not teaching anything. So he writes this great comedy. It reads like something that Mark Twain would have written 30 years later. But here we've got Poe writing about this fellow who's, he grows up just rotten. By the time he's an infant, he's already smoking and drinking and playing cards, so he just turns out rotten. His name's Toby Dammit. And then he develops this habit of boasting. He says, "I bet the devil my head I can outrun you. I bet the devil my head I can outjump you." And then one day, the narrator and Toby Dammit are approaching a covered bridge, and there's a turnstile in the middle of the bridge, and Toby Dammit says, "I bet the devil my head I can leap right over that turnstile." And a little old man shows up and says, "I'll take that bet." So Toby Dammit gets a running start. He jumps over the turnstile. It's a covered bridge. So one of the beams knocks his head right off. The old man catches it, runs away. And they say that Toby Dammit came down with a case of transcendentals. And then eventually they have to sell Toby for dog meat.
So I'll ask, maybe this is the same answer or not, but let's say, you know, everyone has read Poe in high school or whatever, and if you were a person that had done that, read The Raven, maybe a couple short stories when you were in school, and you thought, well, that's okay, but it's not really my thing, but now you want to give Poe a second chance, what would be, like, the most accessible thing someone in that position to go back and read, you think?
I'd probably think, first off, The Cask of Amontillado.
Okay.
A lot of us have read that in school, but when you reread it later, you look at all the foreshadowing and the subtle humor throughout it, and you really see it's a completely different story when you're maybe 12 years old or 13, you're reading it, and it's just this gruesome horror story, but as an adult, you can reread it and see all the humor throughout it and see what Poe's really doing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Berenice's a good one that doesn't get read very often. It's another. It's Berenice. It's one of his first horror stories.
Okay.
It's a story of a man who just is obsessed with his wife's teeth.
Teeth.
Yep.
And what about what about a biography, just for the average person that wanted to know a little bit? Maybe not the you know, the Poe scholar that wants to know every single detail, but what's a good biography to just for general consumption?
Probably the best one to date is Arthur Hobson Quinn's Edgar Allan Poe, A Critical Biography, published about 1941. Uh-huh. And that's the most complete and most balanced and most fair biography to date.
Okay. All right, so before we wrap up here, tell us a little bit. I should have asked you about the museum. What should people know about that, just in a nutshell?
Well, the Poe Museum is the closest thing to meeting Edgar Allan Poe in the flesh. We've been here for 94 years already. It's a four-building complex full of Poe stuff. These are the pieces of his life that you can't see anywhere else. It's like really coming into contact with the author. You get to see his vest, you can see his socks, his walking stick, a lock of his hair, his chair, those letters and manuscripts. You get to follow along with the really intricate, tiny handwriting of Poe. You really get a chance to meet him and see the different dimensions of him. And we have special changing exhibits in one of our buildings throughout the year. Right now we have an exhibit about Poe's parents and his siblings, these overlooked elements of Poe's life that are easy to forget and that most people don't know. But here you get to learn about who his sister was, how she helped shape who Poe was. Also, we'll show you a little bit about the different literary genres in which he works, detective fiction and science fiction, psychological terror, even comedy. But in the middle of this whole four-building complex is the Enchanted Garden. And that was designed in 1922 to be one of Poe's poems come to life. You're stepping into Poe's poem To One in Paradise. And all the details are taken from Poe's poetry. There's flowers, trees, and shrubs mentioned in his poems and short stories. The layout is based on To One in Paradise. The bricks and the granite and the lumber and the walkways came from different buildings where Poe lived or worked in Richmond and New York. So this is the place really to go for a whole Poe experience, to really meet Poe and start to realize what kind of person he was behind those stories.
I agree with what you said about it being beautiful here and all the brickwork and arches and stonework in the house. And it just, it's a really, really special place. And do you have is there a website that people would want to visit maybe to keep up on events or anything?
Yep, it's just poemuseum.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Chris. This has been a really special treat for us. And keep on spooking everyone out here in Richmond.
Will do.
And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor
shall be lifted nevermore.
Join us for our next episode when we're back in North Carolina. For other episodes or to sign up for our mailing list, visit our website at themiddleoftheair.com. See you next time.